Welcome to Module 5 of the High Performance Instructional Leadership Certification Program. Congratulations on passing the halfway point. Keep it up and keep me posted on how it's going in your school. In this module, you're going to be compiling your instructional framework, a set of shared expectations that serves as the basis of your feedback conversations with teachers. I'm going to give you very specific guidance on how to assemble your instructional framework from the pieces you already have, because I found that every school has a mixture of expectations from a variety of sources, and usually there's a lot of variation in the format and specificity of those expectations. For example, you probably have teacher evaluation criteria that are very clear and are in writing and are even part of teachers' contracts. Unless they're new, these shared expectations probably aren't very contentious. They're accepted because they've been clearly communicated to everyone, and everyone from the board on down has agreed to them. So when you use the language of those criteria in a conversation with a teacher, there's no argument about what the teacher evaluation criteria say. It's not a matter of personal opinion, so you can build on that foundation and have a productive conversation. But often we have expectations for teachers that aren't as clear, perhaps because they've never been written down or agreed to, perhaps they're the center of an active controversy in your school, but more likely, they're part of your vision that hasn't been internalized by your staff, at least not with the level of clarity that you'd like. For example, let's say I'm a middle school principal, and I'm not happy about how much teachers are relying on lecture. And I want them to use more active learning activities in their classrooms. I want them to get students doing more instead of just listening passively and taking notes. And to me, that may be a total no-brainer. I mean, it's almost inconceivable to me that teachers would think in this day and age that lecture is the best way to teach. I mean, come on. But here's the situation I'm probably going to find myself in. I don't have anything in writing that says teachers can't use lecture or how much. So when I try to appeal to shared expectations, I don't have much to draw on. So what do I do when I'm talking with teachers? I rely on my personal expectations and I try to convey them to the teacher. And because the teacher is comfortable with lecture and not comfortable with or even very clear on what I'm asking them to do, it becomes a tug of war. When teachers are stuck in a competency trap, when they're good at what they're doing, but it's not really the best thing to be doing, it's really hard to pull them out by relying on personal expectations alone. The key is to use shared expectations, the shared language of your instructional framework, to get crystal clear on what and how things are done in your school. So in this module, I'm going to take you through that process. And especially if you're doing the optional certification component of this program, you'll want to follow along and start pulling together and drafting those documents. Now, before you go out and buy a huge three-ring binder, I want you to know we're going to be pretty efficient with this. You already have most of what you need, and we're not going to reinvent the wheel. And to the extent that you're creating anything new, you're just going to be drafting a very concise outline, and then later working with your staff to flesh that out into a full rubric. Your existing teacher evaluation system is going to be a big part of your framework, and for our purposes in this module, we're going to include the whole thing, but not try to make any changes to it. So you'll be doing a little bit of collecting things that you already have, and a little bit of clarifying expectations that right now are just in your head. By going through the process of being explicit about your expectations, and then seeing to what extent are these already shared with your staff, you'll discover exactly what you need to get everyone on the same page, so that you can have conversations with teachers that move their practice in the right direction, toward a shared vision. So, let's get started. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. If you want to improve teacher practice, it's incredibly powerful to have a shared set of expectations. But where do you get those expectations, and how specific should they be? Because we're interested in developing an instructional framework and not a staff handbook, we're not going to focus too much on things like dress code and teacher attendance policy and other expectations that don't really touch on professional practice. You may have expectations that you consider to be a part of professionalism, for example, about the kinds of clothing that are appropriate and about how people prepare subplans when they're going to be absent. But for our purposes in this section, we're going to focus on the more instructional aspects of teacher practice. But here's the odd thing about those instructional aspects of practice. In most schools, there's a lot more clarity around the staff handbook kind of issues than there is about instructional expectations. Staff handbook issues tend to be more cut and dried, like no jeans except on Fridays, and teachers must take attendance in the computer at the beginning of every period. It's easy to establish clear expectations on those kind of issues, and it's easy to hold people accountable for them. But instructional practice is more complex and nuanced, and holding people accountable isn't always the best way to get good results. If I'm focused on controlling teachers' behavior through school-wide expectations, I might not be giving teachers the latitude that they legitimately need to make instructional decisions that are in the best interests of their students. For example, if I'm a middle school principal and I'm really focused on formative assessment, I might be tempted to say that everyone has to give an exit ticket at the end of every class period. But that's just one strategy, one way of approaching formative assessment. Is that going to be appropriate for every single subject, every single day? What if students just spent the whole period taking a math test? Or what if it's a PE class and students spent the whole period running around the football field? How would it benefit students to have to fill out exit tickets in those cases? See, a best practice is only a good idea when it's guided by the teacher's professional judgment. If we turn it into an accountability-driven expectation, then teachers will implement that best practice rigidly, out of fear, rather than out of informed professional judgment. So ask yourself, for any expectation that you have, would it be a good thing or a bad thing for teachers to follow it without thinking? If it's something like showing up on time, then yes, I want people to show up on time and not come in late telling me that in their professional judgment they needed some Starbucks. It's a cut and dried expectation that people show up on time, and giving people latitude to choose not to follow that expectation would create massive problems for us as an organization. But behavior, what teachers visibly do, is just the tip of the iceberg, and there's a lot more to professional practice. If we want to help teachers do their best work and keep getting better, we need more than staff handbook-style expectations that we can hold teachers accountable to. For most aspects of instructional practice, teacher judgment is essential. The more we try and replace it with cut-and-dried expectations, the worse things are going to be for students. So if something requires thinking and professional judgment, we still need shared expectations, but not rules like you'd find in a staff handbook. We need an instructional framework, and in the next section, we'll talk about four sources of expectations that you can include in that framework. In this section, we're going to look at four primary sources, which should provide most, if not all, of the expectations that will comprise your instructional framework. The first source is your own school-wide expectations. For our purposes here, we're going to focus only on expectations for professional practice that require professional judgment to implement. For example, don't worry about things like your staff attendance policy or how often people need to turn in grades. If it's cut and dried like that, it doesn't need to be in your instructional framework. So, what expectations might you have for teachers' instructional practice at the school level? Well, these can vary quite a bit. Whatever is unique about your school will likely show up in those school-wide expectations, perhaps at kind of a philosophical level. For example, if you're a school that was founded specifically to be a project-based learning school, it might be a school-wide expectation that there's a certain number of major projects that are the focus of each course. If your school has a religious affiliation, you might have a school-wide expectation that a particular worldview permeates instruction in every classroom. If you're in a school that practices full inclusion, you might have collaborative planning among teachers and special education support staff as a school-wide expectation. If you're in a high school that serves a large population of homeless students, you might have personalization and individual support for students, even if they're absent a lot, as a school-wide expectation. And in each of these examples, we could find things that are more cut and dried that could just be rules or policies. For example, if you work in the high school with a lot of homeless students, you might have a no zeros policy. So if a student turns in work late because they didn't have a place to sleep last night, they're guaranteed the same treatment in every classroom. But for the purposes of our instructional framework, we're going to focus on those aspects of practice that require professional judgment. When we get into the details, though, we often find that our school-wide expectations aren't specific or detailed enough to guide teachers' professional judgment. They're too simplistic, and they don't help teachers develop and enhance their judgment as they gain experience. For example, a philosophy is a great starting point, but it's not the same as, say, a rubric that goes into a lot more detail about what good practice looks like. So we should consider school-wide expectations to be the least desirable source of shared expectations, because it's a lot harder to get them specific enough to be helpful while remaining flexible enough to give teachers the latitude they need to exercise professional judgment. This will become clearer as we explore the other three sources for your instructional framework. The next source is your teacher evaluation criteria, which are already written down and possibly even written into your teacher contract or board policy or state law or all of the above. So they're already clear to everyone, and there's already buy-in to them because agreeing to those criteria is a condition of employment. It's not a secret and it's not a surprise. It's literally what teachers are signing up for when they take the job. But sometimes these criteria aren't specific enough to be useful. Once upon a time, it was common for these criteria to be extremely vague. For example, when I started my career as a teacher in Washington State, one of the criteria was interest in teaching pupils. There was no further description of what that meant or description of different levels of performance. It was just interest in teaching pupils, and you could be either satisfactory or unsatisfactory in that, and there wasn't much else to go on. So I'm very happy that we have better criteria today, thanks to systems like Charlotte Danielson's Framework for Teaching. A number of years ago, when the Department of Education's Race to the Top initiative created incentives for states to overhaul their teacher evaluation systems, many public school systems adopted rubric-based teacher evaluation criteria. There are a number of different systems that use multi-level rubrics, like Bob Marzano's, Kim Marshall's, and of course, Charlotte Danielson's. Your school may have its own system that you developed in-house, and if so, that's fine. In this program, we're going to take your evaluation system as a given and not try to make any changes to it, because that can often be a years-long process involving huge numbers of stakeholders. So take your evaluation rubric as it is. If it's not very specific and therefore not very useful as a contributor to your instructional framework, that's fine. You'll just need to draw more heavily on the other three sources. The third source we're going to draw on is training-specific pedagogy. This is where we start to get away from documents that may have been created years or even decades ago and focus on the instructional strategies that teachers are learning right now in professional development. For example, when I started my teaching career in Seattle Public Schools, a huge multi-year literacy initiative was underway. Millions of dollars were spent to train all teachers, K through 12, on a common set of instructional strategies that could be used across grade levels and across subject areas. So if my principal came in and asked me about how I was accessing students' prior knowledge, even though our evaluation system at the time didn't say anything about accessing students' prior knowledge and we didn't have any school-wide expectations about that, my principal knew that I'd been trained on strategies like quick writes and KWL charts, and that shared knowledge could serve as the language of our conversations. We'll consider expectations that are specific to a certain subject area or grade level in just a moment, but for now, think about what other types of training-specific pedagogy you may be able to draw on as you compile your instructional framework. What trainings have all teachers been a part of, and what expectations were set in those trainings? Often these are expectations that focus on culture, climate, and classroom management. For example, restorative discipline, PBIS, positive behavior interventions and supports, Covey's Leader in Me, responsive classroom, and other school-wide approaches are full of expectations that can provide the language for your conversations about practice with teachers. Finally, the fourth source for your instructional framework is curriculum-specific pedagogy. Curriculum-specific expectations are often the most powerful because they can go into so much depth about what students are learning and how they're learning it. But they're harder to learn and use because they're different for each subject or grade level. For example, formative assessment matters whether the subject is English language arts, Spanish, math, or science, but it's going to look different in each of those subjects. As instructional leaders, we face the steepest learning curve when it comes to curriculum-specific expectations. It's worth it, though, because teachers usually gain the most from talking about their practice using the language of these curriculum-specific shared expectations, more than any other type. Especially more experienced teachers who are no longer struggling with the basics like classroom management. This is why it's so important for leaders to attend curriculum trainings alongside teachers. If you want to be a high-performance instructional leader, it helps a great deal to know what and how teachers are being trained to teach in their specific subject areas. That's where you're going to get the vocabulary you need to have useful conversations with teachers about what they're actually teaching. When we don't have this knowledge, this shared vocabulary, we do what everybody else does, and we focus on things like how many students look like they're on task and whether the objective is written on the board, and we can't do a good job of talking about the finer points of the lesson in reference to the teacher's goals. The more you understand the curriculum teachers are working from, the better you can discuss what you observed with their specific goals for the lesson in mind. So to recap, there are four main sources you can draw on as you compile your instructional framework: school-wide expectations, teacher evaluation criteria, training-specific pedagogy, and curriculum-specific pedagogy. As you progress through this module, I'm going to ask you to pull together the documents you have on hand in each of these categories, and you'll identify any gaps that may be left, so you can end up with a concise but thorough instructional framework that gives you a shared vocabulary for talking about professional practice with each teacher. That's it for now. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. As you're compiling the various elements of your instructional framework, you may be wondering how you can turn such a detailed set of nuanced expectations into a practical, easy-to-use observation tool. When you're actually in classrooms, how can you help yourself look for those indicators? I get this question all the time, so I want to be very clear about this. You can't. As you're compiling your instructional framework, you are not creating an observation instrument in any way, shape, or form. Teaching practice is like an iceberg, and when you're observing in a classroom, you're only seeing what's above the surface. You're only seeing the tip of the iceberg. Your instructional framework gives you language to talk about what's beneath the surface of a teacher's practice, but it doesn't give you an observation checklist that allows you to just walk in and check everything off. The Danielson framework is not an observation rubric, and it's incredible to me how many districts are getting this wrong. There is a very good chance that you've been told to use your evaluation instrument as an observation tool, and I'm here to tell you that's inappropriate. So let me be very clear. Your teacher evaluation rubric is not an observation rubric. If you want to refer to it as you're observing a lesson so you can have the right expectations in mind, great, I encourage that. But filling it out like it's an observation rubric is going to be an exercise in frustration because you're not going to be able to see a lot of the things that you're evaluating teachers on because by their very nature, they're beneath the surface. An observation checklist is only appropriate for those cut and dried staff handbook style expectations. If you have a rule that teachers can only wear jeans on Fridays, then it's okay to go into a classroom with the expectation that the teacher won't be wearing jeans on a Tuesday. If you have the crystal clear expectation that teachers won't yell at students, then you can make yourself a checklist that says, not wearing jeans, check. Not yelling at students, check. But that's not what we're talking about in this program, and that's not why I want you to get into classrooms. And if you want to help your teachers grow, going into classrooms with that checklist mentality is going to be a complete waste of time. So your instructional framework will give you a clear set of shared expectations, but the way you use them is as vocabulary, as a shared language, not as a list of observable indicators or look-fors. And here's why. When you do this right, your framework will describe teachers' overall practice, not the structure or features of any particular lesson. For example, I may expect teachers to use assessment effectively, but that doesn't mean that if I visit a classroom for 10 minutes, I should see any particular assessment strategy being used during those 10 minutes. I don't want teachers to use formative assessment when I'm in the room. I want them to use it when it's appropriate. The idea that every aspect of good teaching should be observable during a brief visit is utterly ridiculous. Even if you spent all day every day in a teacher's classroom, you'd still only see what's above the surface, and you wouldn't see the professional judgment and decision-making that went into the teaching that you observed. Nearly all of the opportunity for improvement lies in improving teachers' professional judgment, and the only way we can do that is through conversation. So even if you go through the whole process we're talking about in this module and develop high-quality rubrics for describing teacher practice, the right way to use those rubrics is to talk about the teacher's overall practice in light of the specific evidence that you're collecting. Those rubrics are not tools for evaluating or scoring any particular lesson. And we get confused about this because often we do use rubrics as observation instruments in other contexts. For example, if you're having students give oral presentations and you've given them a rubric for what a good presentation looks like, you can use that as an observation and scoring tool. But that's not how your instructional framework works. Your instructional framework describes the big picture across the entire school year of teacher practice. You can use the language it provides to talk about specific evidence from a specific observation, but not to rate that specific lesson. So as you build your instructional framework, I want to be absolutely clear that it is not an observation tool. It is not a checklist. It's not a form. And if you try to turn it into one, you're going to find that teachers respond by playing games with you. For example, if you take a great concept like Bloom's taxonomy and you turn that into an observation checklist, your teachers are going to get the message that when you're in the room, they'd better show you what you want to see. So they're going to show you higher order questioning with lots of analysis and synthesis questions, regardless of whether that's appropriate for that part of the lesson. If you take what's in your instructional framework and you state it as an expectation that you should be able to see all of the time, every time you walk in the room, you're going to spend your entire day playing games with teachers. When you show up, they'll show you what you want to see, and you'll never get a chance to talk about their thinking and decision making. Why? Because when you ask about why they did something, they can't tell you the truth. The truth is, they did it because you were there, not because it was the best thing to do for kids in their professional judgment. We've got to stop playing these games and forcing teachers to play along. We've got to understand that our instructional frameworks are powerful tools for talking about practice and ultimately powerful tools for evaluating teachers, but if we're using them as checklists or using them to evaluate individual lessons, we're missing the point. So keep the big picture in mind. As you compile your framework of expectations, remember, you're talking about what practice looks like overall, not what any particular lesson looks like. That's it for now. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. Now it's time to identify your teacher evaluation criteria, which will serve as an important part of your instructional framework. Whether your school uses the Danielson framework, another system published by Robert Marzano or Kim Marshall, or a system developed at the state or provincial level, or something you've developed in-house, I'm fairly confident that you already have it in writing. So locate those documents now. If you'll be completing our optional certification component, this will be an important part of your portfolio because it's what you're ultimately accountable for evaluating teachers against. Even if you're not doing the certification, I'd like to ask you to send me your teacher evaluation rubric using the form below or via email, whatever works for you. For now, don't worry about every document related to the evaluation process. For our purposes, all we need is the rubric or the criteria, because that's where we're going to get the language that will become part of your instructional framework. So don't worry about documents related to timelines or instructions on how to complete evaluations or the forms and other paperwork. All we need now is the criteria you'll be using. Before we move on to the next source for your instructional framework, though, I want to talk about a couple of situations you might find yourself in based on the kind of evaluation criteria your school is using. First, if you have a true leveled rubric, like the Danielson framework, where each level of performance is described qualitatively and specifically, you're probably in pretty good shape. Your rubric covers a number of areas of practice, and in each of those areas, there should be 4 or maybe even 5 levels of performance. For example, the Danielson framework uses the labels unsatisfactory, basic, proficient, and distinguished for its 4 levels of performance. It also divides teacher practice into 4 domains and divides each domain into 5 or 6 components. It's not uncommon for states, districts, or even individual schools to add to the commercially available rubrics so that they cover additional aspects of practice that are important in that specific context. For example, Seattle Public Schools, where I worked, added some language about equity to the Danielson framework because equity is a big priority in Seattle. If you work in a school with a religious affiliation, you may have additional language about that in your evaluation rubric. And if you're in a charter school, you may have specific expectations related to the purpose of your school or to the needs of the population you serve written into your teacher evaluation language. So if you have a detailed rubric with leveled descriptions of practice, you're in great shape. Almost as good, but not quite, is what I think of as a frequency rubric. A frequency rubric also has multiple areas of practice and multiple levels of performance for each area, so at first glance, it looks a lot like the first type of rubric. But if you look closely, a frequency rubric really only has descriptions of one level of performance, the proficient level. And the other 3 are just variations in the frequency or consistency of that performance. The levels of performance aren't qualitatively different like they are in the Danielson framework. Instead, they're distinguished by words like sometimes, or consistently, or always. For example, if the proficient column says, the teacher uses a variety of assessment strategies to monitor student learning and adjust lesson plans to ensure that all students master essential content and skills. The other columns will say basically the same thing, but to a different extent. For example, the highest level of performance might say something like, the teacher consistently uses a rich and appropriate variety of assessment strategies to monitor student learning and always adjusts lesson plans to ensure that all students master essential content and skills. And the unsatisfactory column might say something like, the teacher hardly ever or inconsistently uses assessment to monitor student learning and only occasionally makes adjustments. Frequency rubrics are still useful because they provide you with plenty of language for talking about teacher practice, and that's what we really want. If you have a frequency rubric, though, just be aware that there's a risk of focusing on frequency or quantity rather than quality. And that makes it much harder to be accurate in your final evaluation at the end of the year. As an observer, you can't really measure the frequency or consistency of what teachers are doing because you aren't there all the time. So it becomes more difficult to align the evidence you're collecting with the different levels of performance in the rubric because they aren't all that different. If the only difference between unsatisfactory and distinguished is how often the teacher does something, teachers have an incentive to try to convince you they do it all the time. And they can do this just by telling you that they're consistent, and they can try to show you by cramming as much of whatever they think you're looking for into whatever lesson you happen to observe. And since these rubrics often have 20 or more criteria, that can get overwhelming for everyone very quickly. Frequency rubrics also encourage teachers to be defensive rather than honest when they're talking about their practice. Remember, their incentive is to convince us that they do everything all the time because frequency rubrics focus on quantity rather than quality. And if we're trying to see the whole iceberg and help teachers improve their cognition and instructional decision making, that's going to be tough with a quantity over quality mindset. Now contrast that with a truly leveled rubric like the Danielson framework, in which the descriptors are qualitatively different from column to column. For example, Danielson's Domain 1, Component C, is setting instructional outcomes. The unsatisfactory column says the outcomes represent low expectations for students and lack of rigor, and not all of these outcomes reflect important learning in the discipline. They are stated as student activities rather than as outcomes for learning. Outcomes reflect only one type of learning and only one discipline or strand, and are suitable only for some students. And if we compare that to the basic column, we don't just find an increase in consistency or frequency, it's qualitatively different. The basic column reads, outcomes represent moderately high expectations and rigor. Some reflect important learning in the discipline and consist of a combination of outcomes and activities. Outcomes reflect several types of learning, but teacher has made no effort at coordination or integration. Outcomes based on global assessments of student learning are suitable for most of the students in the class. So here you can see we have some new ideas like coordination and integration. The proficient column has even more new ideas that aren't in the lower levels at all. It reads, most outcomes represent rigorous and important learning in the discipline and are clear, are written in the form of student learning, and suggest viable methods of assessment. Outcomes reflect several different types of learning and opportunities for coordination, and they are differentiated in whatever way is needed for different groups of students. So notice that having the outcomes written in the form of student learning and being differentiated weren't even mentioned in unsatisfactory or basic. Finally, the distinguished column for Danielson Domain 1 Component C reads, all outcomes represent high-level learning in the discipline. They are clear, written in the form of student learning, and permit viable methods of assessment. Outcomes reflect several different types of learning, and where appropriate, represent both coordination and integration. Outcomes are differentiated in whatever way is needed for individual students. Now, if you compare proficient and distinguished, you'll see that there is a little bit of that frequency difference, but there's also a qualitative difference. Differentiated in the proficient column becomes differentiated in whatever way is needed for individual students in the distinguished column. So clearly, the best case scenario is to have a truly leveled rubric with qualitatively different levels of performance for each of your teacher evaluation criteria. If you have a frequency rubric where the levels of performance are really all the same, but to differing extents, that's not as good because it doesn't allow us to make evidence-based final evaluation ratings. But it's okay in that it still gives us plenty of language to use in our conversations. What if you don't have either of these, though, and all you have is a checklist of clearly above-the-surface teacher behaviors? For example, one teacher appraisal system I reviewed for a private school had no levels of performance and just a checklist with space to note specific evidence. For example, interacts with students appropriately and is organized and has materials ready were some of the criteria. But those are what we might call cut-and-dried criteria that aren't really about professional judgment. These are the kind of expectations you might find in a staff handbook. So they're not going to give us much language that we can use in our conversations with teachers. So if you have this kind of evaluation criteria that don't add much to your instructional framework, that's okay. Work with what you've got and look for more specific language in your school-specific expectations, training-specific expectations, and curriculum-specific expectations, which we'll talk about in separate sections. For now, use the form below to upload your evaluation criteria. And I'd also like you to tell me whether you think this is a true leveled rubric, a frequency rubric, or a checklist with no levels of performance. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. Let's talk about another source of language for your instructional framework, your training-specific pedagogy. For an expectation drawn from professional development or training to truly be a shared expectation and to become a part of your instructional framework, it needs to meet three criteria, which I'll share in just a moment. The reason these criteria matter is that you and your staff have probably been through a huge number of trainings over the years, and it's easy to forget that not everyone has been through the same learning experiences. So when you use a term like, say, differentiated instruction, you know what you mean, and some other people may interpret it the same way, but others will have a completely different interpretation, and still others may have no idea at all what you're talking about. So the first criterion for training-specific pedagogy to become part of your instructional framework is that all relevant staff must thoroughly be trained in a clear set of common strategies. If something is going to be part of your instructional framework, training is essential, because without that training, it's not really a shared expectation. It's just a buzzword, and buzzwords don't really allow us to have meaningful conversations and be sure that we're talking about the same thing. If you haven't done a training on a certain set of strategies in, say, 5 years, all of your staff who've been hired since then won't know what they are. So ongoing training plus onboarding training for new staff is essential if something is going to become part of your instructional framework. Second, there need to be clear expectations for using those strategies set at the school or district level. So much of what teachers learn in professional development becomes just more water under the bridge, and it's quickly forgotten and replaced with something else. Now, intuitively, you might assume that teachers are expected to keep doing everything they've ever been trained on, but when you start to make a list, you realize pretty quickly that that's impossible. Over time, teachers learn strategies that directly contradict one another, and rather than ignore those contradictions and pretend teachers can keep doing everything, we've got to make clear choices so that we can focus on a coherent set of approaches. Third, we need leveled performance indicators, and this is usually where we have the most work to do. Leveled performance indicators are important in an evaluation system like the Danielson framework, but they're also important at a more granular level when we get into the specific expectations teachers take away from the training and professional development they've been through. If we don't have leveled performance indicators or rubrics, we'll tend to focus on quantity over quality, just as we discussed with teacher evaluation criteria. You don't want your staff to use as many strategies as possible as often as possible. You want them to use the right strategies at the right time as well as possible. And that means these expectations may not apply to all staff. You'll always have some teachers that some expectations just don't apply to. For example, you may have a special ed teacher who works almost entirely one-on-one with students and doesn't use a lot of the classroom management strategies other teachers rely on. So focus on quality and appropriateness, not quantity or frequency. For now, I'm not going to ask you to develop a rubric for every strategy. That's a long-term project, and it's one that your teachers need to be involved in. But I wanted to give you a vision for what that can look like. Shared expectations for training-specific pedagogy can be much more detailed than general teacher evaluation criteria because they apply only to one specific aspect of instruction. For example, if you're in a responsive classroom school, you might have the expectation that all teachers use morning meetings every day, and that they run those meetings in a particular way. And if you've had training for your staff, and you've been to that training, you can be very specific in your expectations for how those meetings are run. So it makes sense to give more specific feedback aligned to what teachers learned in that training. So, for example, if teachers have learned to describe concrete, specific behaviors when providing reinforcement, you can look for that and let teachers know, using your rubric, if they're using general phrases like good job rather than specific descriptions. Because there's a shared expectation, your feedback can be much more targeted without it coming across as critical or excessively picky. But if you just popped into a classroom at some random time and heard a teacher saying good job to a student, it wouldn't be appropriate to criticize the teacher for making that choice. It's only in the context of a specific, shared expectation that that feedback can be useful, because teachers are working to implement a specific model. So now I'd like to ask you to make a list of the current expectations you have for some or all of your staff that are taken from trainings or professional development that your staff has experienced. Divide this list up into sections based on the topic or the training, and list a few expectations for each topic. Don't include anything that's tied to a specific curriculum in just one subject area, because we'll cover those in the next section. For now, just focus on non-curricular or school-wide approaches that teachers have been trained on and that you have shared expectations in. For example, you might have some expectations about how teachers approach classroom climate, others about how teachers begin or end class, and others about using formative assessment. All of these should be based on some training that your staff has participated in recently. And again, it's okay if they don't apply to everyone. Just brainstorm as comprehensive a list as you can and send that to me using the form below. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. Now let's zoom in a bit further and talk about your curriculum-specific expectations. By definition, these aren't going to apply uniformly to all staff, but because they're so specific to what teachers are actually teaching, they're among the most powerful types of shared expectations that will appear in your instructional framework. Now, if you're an elementary administrator and you've been to all the same trainings as your teachers, you may have no trouble coming up with a list of curriculum-specific expectations. But if you're in a secondary school, or you're new to the school, or you weren't able to attend all the trainings, you might be starting this process without much of a sense of the different structures and expectations within each curriculum your school uses. So it's completely normal to have to go to your teachers and ask, what are some of the specific aspects of the pedagogy of this curriculum? What should I be seeing, and what should I be looking for when I'm observing you teaching this subject? Now, teachers may be shocked to hear you ask this question, because usually administrators try to ignore the differences between different subjects and treat instruction as something that's more or less the same in all content areas. And they'll be delighted to tell you, if they know, what specific approaches they're using that they want you to look for. Again, you may not have leveled rubrics, but over time, you can work up to that. So for now, just make a list. What are the elements of curriculum-specific pedagogy that your teachers are striving to implement? Now, unlike teacher evaluation criteria and training-specific pedagogy, these are going to vary widely from subject to subject, and many of these expectations may be entirely new to you because teachers haven't had a reason to share them, and they may even conflict with school-wide expectations, but for good and specific reasons. For example, when I was a middle school science teacher, we adopted a new curriculum that was inquiry-based. And depending on where we were in the unit, students may or may not have had any idea what the purpose of the lesson was. And that was by design, because curiosity and generating questions are central to inquiry-based instruction. So if you had come into my classroom and questioned students about what they were learning and why, they might not have been able to tell you. And if you didn't have the same perspective that I did on inquiry and understand the curriculum-specific reasons for maintaining that sense of mystery about the purpose of the lesson, we would have been working at cross-purposes. So the way to get this information is by asking teachers. Generate an initial list of curriculum-specific pedagogy expectations now, and send that to me using the form below. Then take that list, which you'll also have in your email, and run it by a few teachers. See what they think, and see what they would add. Then expand your list so that you can provide feedback using the subject-specific language that teachers are using. That's it for now. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. Now let's talk about any other shared expectations that you have as a school that you may want to include in your instructional framework. We've saved this type of shared expectation for last because hopefully we've covered most of the bases already when we talked about your teacher evaluation criteria, training-specific pedagogy, and curriculum-specific pedagogy. But there may be a few more things that you want to include based on the unique character of your school. What you don't want to include, though, is anything that belongs in your staff handbook, anything that's a cut-and-dried expectation. For example, anything that teachers are required to do, that you would write a letter of reprimand about if they didn't, does not belong in your instructional framework. So this is not the place to list things like teachers will turn in lesson plans, or teachers will dress appropriately, or show up on time. The kind of school-specific expectations that you want to include in your instructional framework are those that touch on teachers' instructional decision-making. For example, if you have a no-zeros policy for late work, you might have specific expectations for how teachers work with students who've been absent a lot, perhaps due to chronic homelessness, to help them catch up on their work. If you're a project-based learning school, you might have not just policies, but instructional expectations about the way that teachers design the project work students are doing. Any shared expectations that touch on teachers' instructional decision-making that are unique to your school should go here. Using the form below, brainstorm a list and send it to me, and then share it with a few staff members, for example, your leadership team. This is not the time to come up with new expectations, so you're really looking for expectations that are already widely shared among your staff. Generate that list now in the form below, and I'll see you in the next section. Over the long term, we want to shift away from having checklist or buzzword-based lists of expectations and upgrade those lists to full-on leveled rubrics that give clear descriptions of your expectations for teaching practice. That's long-term work to do with your staff, but I want to give you at least a little bit of experience converting your expectations into rubrics in this section. Now, everyone knows what a rubric is, but not all rubrics are equally useful. In particular, I want to caution you against using frequency rubrics, which really only have one level of quality that's really described in detail, and then the other levels are just variations in how often or how consistently the teacher does what's in that satisfactory column. For example, if the unsatisfactory column just says, hardly ever does what's in the satisfactory column, and the distinguished or outstanding column just says, always or consistently does what's in the satisfactory column, then you have a frequency rubric. A good rubric might mention frequency or consistency, but overall, there should be major qualitative differences between the descriptions in each column. It's not just more or less of the same. And this is important because as instructional leaders, we can't really judge the frequency or consistency of what teachers are doing if we only see a tiny fraction of their total instruction. But you can triangulate what you see with what your rubric says if each column in the rubric is qualitatively different. For example, in Charlotte Danielson's Framework for Teaching, Domain 2, Component A is creating an environment of respect and rapport. The unsatisfactory column says, patterns of classroom interactions both between teacher and students and among students are mostly negative, inappropriate, or insensitive to students' ages, cultural backgrounds, and developmental levels. Student interactions are characterized by sarcasm, put-downs, or conflict. The teacher does not deal with disrespectful behavior. Notice, none of that is about frequency or consistency, and in contrast, look at the distinguished column. Classroom interactions between the teacher and students and among students are highly respectful, reflecting genuine warmth, caring, and sensitivity to students as individuals. Students exhibit respect for the teacher and contribute to high levels of civility among all members of the class. The net result is an environment where all students feel valued and are comfortable taking intellectual risks. You see how those are qualitatively different? The vocabulary is entirely different from one column to the next, and in conversation with a teacher, as you talk about the evidence from your observations, you'll be able to tell which description fits. You'll be able to triangulate. And this is the power of an instructional framework. It allows you to take an honest and rigorous look at teacher practice without making the rating the focus. In fact, as you master the language of your instructional framework, you don't even have to refer to it at all. You don't have to pull out the rubric and say, well, this looks satisfactory or this looks distinguished. Instead, the rubric is a preparation tool for you, giving you the terminology to use to describe what you're seeing in the classroom. So what I'd like to ask you to do now is take one expectation from your instructional framework that you've shared with me so far, something that currently is just a buzzword or a short description that hasn't been turned into a leveled rubric, and I'd like you to take a shot at that. Write out four different leveled descriptors, specifying what unsatisfactory, basic, proficient, and distinguished, or level 1, level 2, level 3, and level 4 practice would look like. Send that to me using the form below, and when you've done that, you're ready to move on to the next section. Congratulations on reaching the end of Module 5. We've talked about a lot of different aspects and features of your shared instructional framework in this module, and now it's time to loop in your staff. An instructional framework is only useful if it's truly shared, so I'd like you to take the work you've done so far and share it with a few key teachers, perhaps your leadership team or some of your stronger teachers whom you know will give you good feedback on what you have so far. Ultimately, you want to make sure your instructional framework isn't a document that you own as a leader, but that it's something that your staff owns, that they really believe in and buy into. Moving forward, this set of documents is going to serve as the arbiter in your conversations with staff. When you take notes in a classroom and describe what you saw, your instructional framework is going to be the authority on what good teaching looks like. It's going to give you the right language to use so that you can be ultra-specific in describing what you see. And it's going to take away a lot of the power struggle that often exists between teachers and administrators. Instead of a battle of wills or conflicting opinions, what you'll have is a set of evidence in the form of your notes and a clear rubric for interpreting that evidence. So have a few conversations with teachers and get feedback on what you have so far. And when you're ready, I want you to set up a phone call with me where we'll talk about what's in your instructional framework. And I can help you get that set up in our repertoire app if you're using it or would like to. Use the link below to get on my calendar, and we'll set up a phone call at a time that works for both of us. That's it for Module 5. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in Module 6, where we'll talk about how to use your instructional framework and the evidence you collect while visiting classrooms to have conversations with teachers that actually change their practice.